Ryan, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly well. I apologize for having kept you waiting for quite a bit of time. I think 20 minutes or so. Is that still okay with you?
That's absolutely fine. And I'd just like to say that I don't speak German, but it was fascinating watching you and listening. And I'd just like to say that it was wonderful to see you start laughing, because you looked very serious for most of the dialogues that I've listened to. Yeah. But there was one word that I picked up that I found very interesting, and that was Wahnsinn. And that came up several times, particularly when Bianca was speaking. And I'd like to start.
You know what that means, right?
Madness.
Yeah, yes. Madness. It's madness.
That's what it is.
Yes, and I'm going to say to you, it's not madness. What we are facing is calculated, and it's a mistake to call it madness, because it's very precise, it's very calculated. And we need to understand that in order to be able to deal with what we're facing.
That's very interesting to hear, because we have come to the conclusion that the other side, as we call them, is using two major tools. One is, of course, psychological operations. And of course, the other, which transports this psychological operation, is the mainstream media. Can you explain, tell us a little about your background?
Okay, well, my personal background is professionally, I was military. I was in the Royal Navy for 21 years. I then worked in industry, essentially, for a while. But after a few years, I began to understand that things were not good in the UK. And I began to see things and investigate things. Ultimately, that's led me over nearly another 20 years to team up with a gentleman called Mike Robinson. And for now 14 years, we've been running a media outlet called the UK Column, mm-hmm. And I'm delighted to say that we're expanding, and it's clear that our viewers and listeners are now not only UK, they're across the world.
Excellent. And now, of course, you're busy covering Corona and all the ramifications of what Corona brings about.
Mm-hmm. Well, the key point is that we originally started by looking at some of the issues that you've just mentioned. So we were looking at how propaganda had come into the country. We were looking at the use of applied behavioral psychology by the government. And we were looking at changes which were very serious, or we thought they were very serious, and they were particularly affecting the style of democracy, and they were also affecting our constitutional rights. And it was against that background of reporting that we have then encountered, obviously, what's happened with coronavirus. And so I would say to you that our analysis of what has happened of coronavirus is seen very much against the background of what was happening politically, and in particular the use of applied behavioral psychology and propaganda.
Yeah. So what do you think is the calculated madness? I mean, the madness is more from what, you know, our judgment from when we look at what was the normal status of things before. You know, no one would have thought, had you asked us like a year ago, no one would have thought that this could have ever happened. I mean, at least not us, I guess. And also we're really surprised how the legal system has deteriorated, or at least how it has become obvious that it's sort of in really bad shape. Yeah. But it seems that, we also have the feeling, you know, at the same time that it's very orchestrated what's happening. You know, that it's really like, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. It's all like, you know, they move this piece and then the picture. I mean, it's becoming more and more clear, you know, what's going on. But what are your experiences or your analysis of the situation?
Well, I first of all, I'd agree with you that the coronavirus pandemic, we will call it that, with inverted commas, that did catch everybody by surprise. I don't think we saw that coming, and it happened very quickly. So I'd certainly agree with you on that. But I'll come back to the fact that we started to see very, very serious things happening in the UK. And if I just focus immediately on the government's use of applied behavioural psychology. Now, back in 2010 and 2011, we as the UK column were warning that the government had set up a team, which was called the Behavioural Insights Team. This was a team of psychologists who were working directly alongside not only the political process, but the policy forming process within the British government. And a critical document, which we found in 2010, was called MindSpace. That's MindSpace. You can find it very easily by searching online for it as a PDF document. But in that document, the government admitted that it was using applied behavioral psychology to influence how it designed policy and how it implemented policy. And at one particular point in that document, in fact, it's on the bottom of page 66, if I remember correctly, the government boasts that it can change the way people think and behave, and the people will not be aware that this has been done to them. But it adds the caveat that if they do realise that their behaviour is changed, they will not know how it was changed. And we read this document and we were shocked. And we then started to research further. And that then led us to discover that around that time, and of course a little bit earlier, the British government had been conducting meetings with the French, at which we were bringing the British psychology teams together to produce joint plans with the French. And the key Frenchman who was present in the meetings was called Oliver Willier, and he was working directly at that time for Sarkozy's private office. Now, all these meetings were essentially held in secret. We were able to discover that they'd taken place, but we were only able to discover that by carefully researching along specific routes, which we understood were important. And for an example, most of these meetings were conducted under the guise that they were part of a charity, the Franco-British Council, which said it was simply set up in order to improve relationships between Britain and France. So these meetings took place, and it was very clear that there was concerted effort to expand the use of these techniques, not only from Britain and France, but the implication at that time was that these techniques were going to be used across the wider power base of the European Union. And I'll just say again, the MindSpace document was boasting that this was the first time the government would be able to use and apply techniques where people would have their behaviour change. That means their thoughts change, and they wouldn't even be aware that it had occurred.
For what purpose?
Well, if you want to execute power, then you're going to try and use normal democratic politics, or you're going to try and use force, or you're going to try and use other means. And so this comes to me as other means. And I have to say that when I saw how cynical this was, how calculated it was, when I was using effectively my military background, I could see that this was the use of raw power. Now, if I jump forward into events around COVID, very early on in the COVID pandemic, I've called it a pandemic, of course, I don't believe that that is what it is, but that's how it was reported. But very early on, it came to our attention that the government scientific advisory group, SAGE, had actually had an internal meeting with elements of the government's behavioural insights team. The key gentleman concerned with this was a man called Dr. David Halpin, that's H-A-L-P-I-N. And at that meeting, which was not properly minuted in a proper official sense, but they did put out a briefing sheet from the meeting. And in that document, which was dated, I think, the 22nd of March 2020, it admitted that the SAGE team and the government's policy on coronavirus, sorry, a little bit of noise in the background, was going to use applied psychology in order to ramp up fear in the population, in order to get the population to adhere more closely to the government's policy over the response to coronavirus. This was very, we have the document, we can provide you a copy of that document.
Yes, because we have the same thing.
It is a leaked paper from the Secretary of the Interior, and it is now called the Panic Paper.
Yes, I've heard about the paper in Germany. I haven't seen it or been able to read it in English. I'm going to suggest to you that that German paper would have come out of the specific talks that I've just referred to. So when we started to see that the British government was having these secretive meetings with French behavioural applied psychology experts, it was clear to us that this was going to be rolled out in other European countries. So I was not surprised when I heard about that German document. Now, in the SAGE document, aside from saying that they were going to ramp up fear, there was something very interesting. It said that inside communities, community members were going to be used to effectively police each other. So people were going to be used to put pressure on their fellow community neighbours, for example, to wear a mask, to adhere to social distancing. So it was very clear in what they were talking about that they were going to use this covert applied psychology to pressurize citizens to act against one another. And significantly, they also said that this had to be done with some care because they believed that it was possible this situation could get out of control. And clearly what they meant by that is that instead of having somebody saying to somebody else, you should wear a mask, that requirement could be translated into violence. So the documents were, there's no ifs or buts or questions, the document.
You're mute.
I think you're muted. We can't hear you. There's something.
Maybe it's not supposed to be heard.
Maybe somebody's trying to not let you communicate with us.
Maybe could you leave the Zoom and come back in? Oh, yeah, it's now you're back.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's probably my internet connection, but I do get problems these days for whatever reason.
Okay.
So, having told you about that document, very clear cut, very specific, I can now come back again to Bianca talking, because I could understand a little bit of what she was talking about, and she talked about angst.
Yes.
She was talking about stress.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the techniques that are being used on adults, these psychological techniques to induce stress and fear, are of course also being used on the children. And I couldn't understand, well, I could only understand a tiny bit of what she was talking about, but I understood enough to say that she was saying, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think she was saying that the rules change, so she doesn't know what the rules are from time to time.
Exactly, yeah.
Every
week they changed the rules so that she had to sit at her desk over the weekend in order to figure out how to make these things work.
Right. And what that is the uncertainty and the change in the rules. That is part of the psychological attack, because the uncertainty immediately is putting people in a position of stress and anxiety and confusion. And if we go back into the professional world of applied psychology, people who are in a distressed, confused state are very susceptible to further messages and instructions. If there's a fire in a building and people are starting to panic, the first person that starts to give clear commands to the people, those commands will be followed. And that is due to the psychological state. Now, I'm talking to you. I'm not trained. I'm not professionally trained in psychology. I do know a reasonable amount, which I've now learned as a result of the investigations that I do. But the other point that I want to bring into this is that many years ago, we started to get very interested in a charity called Common Purpose. And Common Purpose as a charity said it was there to create future leaders in society. It effectively, it was like an octopus. It had tentacles. It got into the hospital system. It got into the police. It got into the military. It got into schools. And once inside these organizations, it was essentially spreading a new philosophy in many areas. Now, everything I'm saying to you is fully documented. I have a website which is packed full of documents talking about what this organization was doing. It particularly went for children. In the earliest days, it was going for children of the age of about 11 to 14, but it also was interested in university students. And aside from the fact that people who went on courses were selected, they were also very keen to get younger people into their so-called training courses. Now, when I was investigating this organization, because I was extremely suspicious about what it was doing, it was a very interesting claim to be choosing future leaders who were going to lead outside society, who were going to lead outside authority. We'll come back to that. But the training was clearly designed to produce people working in an organization who were not working in the normal culture of the organization. Common Purpose had given them a new set of values. And when I took some expert advice on how they were doing this, this is the first time that I was told about the technique of neuro-linguistic programming, NLP. Now, NLP is it's actually a form of hypnosis. You can look on the internet and you will find many consultancies providing training in NLP. And you will find many people providing training saying that it has a therapeutic, it can be used to care for people and help for people. Now, in essence, this is true. But what we were interested in is where we started to see the use of neurolinguistics in government policy. So bring these two together. It is a fact that the British government set up a specific applied psychology team. It is a fact that that team were promoting ideas to make the population fearful around the pandemic. but on a much bigger scale, that team was using, amongst other things, NLP in order to influence virtually every document that the government was producing. I don't know whether any of your team have come across NLP before, but I will say that it's an open secret. You can go and research it. Many professional people teach it. But essentially, it's a form of hypnosis. And this means that you can put across ideas and concepts to people, which is not necessarily just going through their conscious mind. This is fact. This is not fiction. Now, when you start to see NLP being used for political objectives, of course, the wider public is very, very vulnerable. Because unless you have a little bit of training or knowledge of NLP, you won't even realize that it's being used on you. And it can be used in a verbal sense, but it can also be used in writing. So for an example, you can have a document in front of you. You may notice that we call it a full stop, at the end of a sentence, that marker is in the wrong place. And you believe that somebody made a mistake when they were typing. But this is not what NLP can do, because when you are reading the sentence and you come to the full stop, your conscious mind makes one decision, but your subconscious mind makes another one. And it is perfectly possible to be writing documents where it appears that one message is being put across, but actually a completely different message is being put to the audience. And if I bring this into the realm of coronavirus and reaction, we are now seeing that every statement made by the by the government, every piece of paper that comes out, is invariably very carefully crafted. It's very carefully put together. And I will say, I can see that in much of this documentation, carefully applied psychology is being used in the written word. To back that up, to reinforce that, we also have government documents where they are specifically boasting of being able to use psychology in written documents.
So you think that also the leaked documents that we see, like for instance this panic paper which was leaked by someone, or at least it was not like officially put out, I mean, this created a lot of fear, I guess, also because people could, I mean, some people could see through this, through the whole narrative then after reading the paper. But actually I suppose like even the fact that it came out and some people read it or heard about it, you know, who were stuck in the fear narrative, maybe it even put them into more fear. Just the way that it's, you know, that it was designed. I mean, that you get this, like a lot of an outcry about, you know, like people were upset that the government would use this picture of like your grandma being suffocated by you, the child who, infects her with coronavirus. But I mean, once this picture is kind of in the official realm, some people hear it and then, you know, have these fantasies in their head and get even more afraid.
Well, that is absolutely correct. And we can see here in UK that particularly the BBC has been using applied psychology in this way, heavily emotive, distressing photographs with very little factual reporting to support the image, the idea given in the photograph. This is deliberate, it's calculated, and it's now very, very easy to see that this is taking place. So the background of everything that's happened with the pandemic, we know that every speech that's made, every document that goes out is likely to contain a reinforcing psychological message. But the other thing that I think is important from UK at least, if we go back to 2010, excuse me. if we go back to 2010, when that Mindspace document was released, within a year, we're starting to see the first of exercises which are going to prepare for a pandemic. So in 2011, we had a thing called Exercise Cygnus, which was the UK Influenza Pandemic Preparedness Plan. And that was followed by other official documents talking about a possible future pandemic. And then in 2017, there was a very significant document called Preparing for the Next Pandemic. Now, what was and what is interesting in reading these documents is that some of them, not all, but some of them qualify the document by saying, well, we can't predict a pandemic will happen. We can look long term over what's happened in the world. We can look back to 2018 and the flu pandemic and the damage, but we can't be certain of when there will be another future pandemic. But suddenly, in a very short space of years, we can see in the UK a flurry of papers. And again, we can make these available to you, where suddenly people are all talking about the coming pandemic. Now, these are UK political and public documents. They are not even on the level of, if we move into the SPARS pandemic type documents, where these big exercises have been run in America and elsewhere, looking at the possibility of a pandemic coming. This is a cluster of paper and supposed research in UK, which is quite extraordinary. Is it a coincidence that in a few years you have paper after paper warning that a pandemic is coming? And what I can see when I read the papers is very little fact, but a lot of emotive language. And of course, people who had a job in, we would say, the public sector, in the lower government system, they would have been very susceptible to reading this material and then thinking, my goodness, we need to make local preparations for this. So I look at these documents and I'm pretty confident that what we are seeing is the seeding of ideas of a coming pandemic. And of course, those seeds were placed in people's minds. And then the moment we started to get reports of a pandemic coming, particularly for us in the BBC, people would have started to become worried, would have started to think about that material and would have started to really react in a way that the government would want. So we've got both the substantive evidence showing that the British government will and does use applied psychology to get its policies across. We've got that substantive evidence saying that they're going to go as far as making people fearful. And I'll add, if you make people stressed and fearful, you're also going to give them mental health problems. And we now live in a country where there's a huge rise in depression and suicides, none of which is being talked about in the mainstream press, because the increase in those adverse mental health effects has been so huge since the lockdown policies have been in place. This is an elephant in the room in the UK. So we have the evidence in documents of this type of calculated, destructive applied psychology. But then you can also see, if you start talking to people in public services, you can talk to doctors and nurses in the National Health Service here in the hospital service, and they are telling us that they also witnessed the sudden flood of these papers, effectively preparing them for a pandemic that was coming. But this was a pandemic that the papers said couldn't be predicted. Yeah. Now, would you like me to keep talking, or do you want to question me?
I have a question. question, Brian. And this is, you know, at the beginning of today's session, Dr. Vodak, who's still with us, and I discussed the fact that a new narrative has been put out into the mainstream media, probably starting out in the United States with Fox News, which is part of the mainstream media, and they have a host by the name of Tucker Carlson. And he explained on one of his news shows that finally there will be justice because Fauci has been caught lying to the public about his involvement with the Wuhan virology lab and how he had conducted gain of function experiments there, which was being financed behind the back of the American taxpayer and against the will of the government with US dollars, tax dollars. But the real message wasn't we're going to get Fauci. The real message was Fauci didn't tell us that there was a dangerous virus escaped from the Wuhan lab. Now, in the meantime, we know that there was there was probably an accident at the Wuhan lab, but it didn't cause any real damage. However, those people who seem to have been preparing for this agenda to be rolled out, as you just explained, and as others have explained to us before, those people took this opportunity and used this as a springboard in order to start rolling out the pandemic, which is really a plandemic, and which is really only a PCR test pandemic. Would you agree with that? And in reality, and this is really important, in reality, we do not have a dangerous virus because the WHO, in accordance with what John Ioannidis says, they put the danger of this pandemic at about the level of a common flu. 0.14, 0.15% infection fatality rate. So would you agree that this is really not a pandemic, but this is a coordinated effort? This is, as you, when you first started out talking to us, this is a, it is not madness, it is a calculated effort which uses uses lots of psychology, NLP, in order to keep people in fear, in order to make them do things that they otherwise wouldn't do?
Well, I certainly do believe that. There's a number of points there in what you've just said to me. So the first important one, all of the evidence that's come in through the UK column and our analysis has shown that even the government's own statistics have proven that what is happening is effectively a normal flu season. And although they tried extremely hard to manipulate and skew bend the statistics, the actual statistics that our Centre for the National Office of Statistics in UK, it did its job. The statistics which that centre pushed out to the public were actually correct and showed that there was no pandemic. But the government's interpretation on it was a blatant twisting of the facts and the information in order to...
Yeah. Same thing happened here.
Yes, and I can reinforce that statement by saying to you that we have a stream of people coming to us, doctors and nurses, saying that at the time the British government was claiming hospitals were full of COVID-19 patients, they were not full. Even specialist facilities that were created in hospitals never had a patient going through them. Never mind the big centres set up in London for thousands of patients that ended up, I think, with about 63 patients in a multi-thousand facility. In hospitals, we have had hospital consultants telling us that they were responsible for setting up specialist COVID wards, which they did. And when those wards were set up, they never had a single COVID patient in them. And while that was happening, the British government sent elderly people who clearly did have flu. They were in the hospitals and they had flu. They were ill. the government sent those elderly people in their thousands back into the care and residential homes, where, of course, in a closed environment, that infection spread. And even the wider press, certainly the newspapers in UK, the Daily Express, I think the Daily Mail and the Telegraph and the Guardian, all reported at one stage that the evidence was that tens of thousands of elderly people had died unnecessarily. Now, the experts that talk to us in the UK column say the figure is not tens of thousands, it's hundreds of thousands. So we have the lie over whether it was a pandemic. And of course, one of the tricks that the British government and the BBC has used is that they talk about the statistics relating to COVID-19 in a cumulative sense. They keep adding the figures together. But of course, flu is always logged as a seasonal occurrence. The flu season comes, people catch flu, some people die, that's always the case. And then, of course, as the seasons get better, flu disappears. And then for the next winter, that is a new flu season and the statistics start again. But with COVID, the statistics have been added across the two seasons. Now, this is the use of psychology to manipulate people's minds. It's absolutely blatant. Fauci, you mentioned Fauci. I believe that what you're seeing at the moment is a smokescreen. Yes, there are questions that need to be asked about what was happening in the Wuhan lab. And certainly we know that it has been standard procedure for many years that if a vaccine is to be created, that the pharmaceutical companies will enhance a virus strain as part of their techniques for producing a new virus. So we can imagine that in any laboratory, dangerous enhanced viruses might be created. Sorry. I have some special things happening with traffic near my house. So we know that laboratories are doing what is essentially dangerous work on the enhancing of vaccines, of viruses. So it is, of course, possible that something escaped. But I think that the timing that we're now suddenly turning attention back onto Fauci is very interesting. And I believe that this is being done because they know that the wider public is starting to ask the right questions about what has been done as a result of the COVID-19 vaccination policy. So to try and distract people away from asking the key questions, which I'd like to come on to, about vaccination, they're now coming back to Fauci. And of course, the other man who has suddenly disappeared from the public arena is Bill Gates.
Yeah.
Now, why has Bill Gates disappeared? Well, a number of interesting questions, but of course the first problem he faced was that it was known that he had a friendship with Epstein. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, Mr. Bill Gates as being the squeaky clean, sorry, a bit of colloquial English there, as being the very clean, well-behaved, entrepreneurial, philanthropic businessman is now smeared with the fact that he had a very questionable friendship with Epstein. And of course, Melinda Gates has now said that she warned her husband about that relationship many years ago. So suddenly Bill Gates is now been exposed in the wider media. That happened first, and now suddenly we're getting attention focused back on Fauci. My feeling is that the people who are responsible for this despicable plan have now started to think that the public is beginning to look in the right direction, and so they need something to distract them. And I think we're going to see a ramping up of accusations that it was the Chinese who produced a bioweapon, Fauci was involved. This is all emotive media stuff. This is not proper analysis of what's been happening. But that's my personal opinion, so I could be wrong.
Actually, I think we agree with that. And everyone who we've spoken to agrees with that. It looks as though those who are responsible for this agenda are beginning to throw people under the bus, but obviously only for this very purpose, to distract the general public's attention from what they're doing. They're asking the right questions. Yes. So in a way, I think this shows that they're losing control to a degree. They're not losing complete control, but they're losing control. What do you think about this?
I agree with that. And I'm going to say that if we want to inject some good news into our discussion, the people we are up against, the people we are fighting, are inherent liars. They tell lies. They do not tell the truth. And of course, the problem with that is eventually they become caught in their own lies. And so I think this is a big part of what started to happen. But I can give you another example from within UK of where we see that there has suddenly been some emerging fear in the system. The UK agency, which is responsible for the safety and regulation of medication, is called the MHRA, the Medical and Healthcare Products Regulation Agency. And that is the organization which has been collecting data on vaccine adverse effects. And for you and anybody who's ultimately watching or listening, I need my glasses for this, apologies. Their latest reports are that within the UK, there have been 859,481 adverse reactions. That's logged.
Did you say 850,000?
859,000. 859,481, and there have been 1,213 deaths. Now, those statistics are the UK government's own statistics. They've not come from me, they've come from the UK government, and they come from the MHRA yellow card system. And this is supposedly the safety system by which anybody who comes into contact with an adverse vaccine reaction, whether it is something you experience to yourself, or you witness as a family friend, or indeed if you're somebody in the medical profession, you should log a yellow card vaccine adverse reaction message. And it is the MHRA that holds that database. Now, in the MHRA's own documentation, they stated in 2018 that to their knowledge, for any medication, including vaccines, less than 10% of the serious adverse reactions were ever recorded. Less than 10%. And for more minor vaccine adverse reactions, they said that the figure recorded would be between 2 and 4%. Now, if we consider that statement against 859,000 adverse reactions and 1,213 deaths, we could be looking at 12,000 people who've died. We, as the UK column, have reported a great deal about this data, and on the UK column website, my colleague Mike Robinson has provided a search engine so that you can search the MHRA's own data. And this is very interesting because you cannot search the data on the MHRA's website. It simply provides it as sheets of data. This, of course, is very confusing and misleading for the public. But the caveat that maybe only 10% of serious effects got recorded is very significant. in the last couple of weeks, the MHRA added a new paragraph in relation to that caveat about the low reporting of adverse effects. And they said, of course, the figure of 10% and 2 and 4% does not apply to yellow card reports of COVID-19 vaccines. Adverse effects. Have I lost you?
No. There was someone talking.
There was someone talking who forgot to mute his phone, his microphone, rather.
Mm-hmm. So once the UK column started to draw the public's attention to the fact that the MHRA already had 859,000 adverse effects recorded and 1,200 deaths, and that might only be a very small proportion of the total number of adverse reactions, the MHRA attempted to deceive the public by posting a notice saying that this 10% did not apply to adverse reactions as a result of COVID-19 vaccinations.
But did anyone buy this?
Some people will inevitably buy it, because members of the public who read this information without having a fuller understanding are still in the psychological position that they believe what the government tells them. And this is a very big mistake, of course. So some people did believe them, but some didn't. Now, we challenged, as a media organisation, we challenged very strongly. And then something very interesting happened, because the MRHA suddenly announced in the last few days that it was going to have a special initiative for patient information and safety. But when you look at the documents they produced, there's words on the paper, but the documents do not actually say what they are going to do to improve patient safety. And the other part of the story in the UK is that the MHRA has overall responsibility for logging vaccine adverse effects. But what they are not doing is then investigating to produce the final conclusion on whether an effect was indeed created by a vaccine or not.
Yeah, same here.
And if it's the same in Germany, then we are starting to see that there's a pattern emerging. This cannot be an accident. This cannot be a coincidence.
No, and it's really amazing. We just discussed this like earlier on in the show that, you know, they're not doing autopsies. So they're really refusing it. Either comes from the district attorneys, or it's somehow, I don't know, hindered by behind the scenes political decisions, whatever. They're not doing any autopsies on the people, you know, who were like registered or like, you know, declared by their relatives or something, that could maybe be like a causality with regard to the vaccines, and they're not looking at it. And if they do, they say, oh, there's no connection, even after doing like a minor, you know, really just a short look at it or something. They say, oh, there's no connection, cannot be.
Well, that is also happening in UK, that postmortems are not being conducted. And we've even seen where the MHRA, this is factual because we have interviewed the family concerned. The family had their father died of a heart attack very shortly after receiving a vaccination. And the hospital did not submit a yellow card report. And later, when the family had submitted that report, but nothing happened, 6.5 weeks passed, they then said to the MHRA, what are you doing to investigate the death? And the first thing the MHRA asked them was there a post-mortem? Well, of course, the responsibility to the post-mortem comes from the medical team, who should have taken a decision that it could be linked to the vaccine. Therefore, there was a need for the post-mortem. or when it was too late and the person had been buried, then the MHRA said, well, there wasn't a post-mortem, right? And the other thing that happened in UK probably about 2 years ago, originally death certificates had to be signed by two doctors. And this, within the pandemic, was changed that there only had to be one signature. And constantly on the death certificate, COVID was recorded when family members said, but my father, my mother, my brother died of cancer. But because they supposedly tested positive for COVID-19, that was actually recorded as the cause of death. So this is the official falsification of statistics with a direct impact on the health of the nation. This is calculated. And this is why I come back to the fact that it is not madness. If you analyze very carefully the political decisions, the policies, the documents, what we are looking at is genocide. It's planned, it's premeditated. And I've even had a senior member of the National Health Service who has spoken to us as a whistleblower use that very term. The words were, what I have watched unfolding within the health service in UK is genocide.
Wow.
That was a member of the medical community, or I didn't get that.
That was a board member of one of the NHS boards.
Wow.
So we have nurses telling us this. We have had nurses using the term genocide. I have some doctors who are also using this term, but they're not using it lightly, and they're not using it because they're aware that other individual used it. It comes out as a word when you interview them about their experiences and what they have seen.
And do you think the rush to vaccinate the children? You know, we have now the government said that from June 7th on, the children are supposed to be vaccinated, and everything is supposed to be done and over before the next school year. So, I mean, this seems to be like pretty outrageous. Obviously, a lot of people are very upset about this new thing. I mean, they say it's not going to be like mandatory, but of course, with peer pressure and with like, you know, them saying you can only access the schools again with like testings or with vaccination or only vaccination. I mean, of course, there's pressure. I mean, it's basically mandatory, or it's going to become mandatory. But I wonder, do you think they are now rushing this through because they see that the side effects of the vaccinations are going to become more and more obvious? So people are maybe like if they start to introduce this late in the year, quite a few parents might shy away from the vaccinations. And now it's still in between, and you know, with like maybe the option to go on vacations, it's maybe a good idea to kind of lure people or like sort of nudge people into like now also getting the children vaccinated. What's your take on that?
Well, I totally agree with your analysis there. It is very clear that there is now a massive urgency to vaccinate children. And we can see the overt statements, the open statements. One of the politicians, Jeremy Hunt, stood up in Westminster a couple of days ago and basically said that it was vital that we started to vaccinate school children. So we can see open statements, but we can also see other documentation circulating where, again, there is this malicious use of psychology because school teachers are effectively being told that if they encounter parents who are reluctant to have their children vaccinated, those parents are effectively going to be listed as extremists. So we can again see this psychological wedge coming in to break people away from their children. And of course, if you get the parents away from the children, then the government can do what they like with the children. as I say this to you, I think it's reasonable for me to say that many years ago, 20 years ago, I was reading a very informative political book called The EU Collective, Enemy of Its Member States. And in that book, there was a table which purported to be a table of a psychological attack on Western nations. And it involved a period of demoralization. It involved a period of destabilization. And the ultimate 5 years was that there was going to be complete chaos and collapse. And as I read that table, and I hadn't long been out of the military in that stage, but I read it and my mind said, some of this is happening around us. I could think of examples. And I have given public talks on part of this idea, I'll say idea, that a psychological attack is being, a demoralizing attack is being unleashed on our respective nations. And I believe that that is the case. And I think that when you see the way that the policy for this COVID scam, this lie, when you see that the policy is mirrored in UK, in France, in Germany, and across all the other countries, then we can see that clearly the power base that's injecting this is not democratic in any form. It's hostile to us. And I'll just add, because it was a little thing I didn't want to forget, that I only discovered a couple of days ago that Bill Gates had supported an organization called CEPI, which is the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness. And Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation had put in several hundred million dollars to that organization. Well, by a miracle, CEPI ended up by funding the very biological testing laboratory that the MHRA in the UK was going to use, is using, to tell us whether the vaccines are safe. So Bill Gates' money goes into CEPI. From CEPI, it goes to support the very laboratory that is being used to tell us that vaccines are safe on the basis that they've recorded 860,000 side effects, approximately. But they haven't done any correlation as to whether there's causation there with the vaccines themselves. That research has not been done. So it is obvious that what you have is a system that has been set up in order to deceive the public from what is truly happening with these vaccines. And I think they want the children, because they are now scared enough to see the right questions being asked, and they know that if they want to get the children vaccinated, they've got to hurry.
I have one more question. So when we're looking at all these the measures, you know, when we're looking at the masks, this bizarre testing, now the vaccination, and you know, the social distancing, do you think these are like foremost like the have a psychological aspect of like being, you know, that your power struck or like that you have to your obedience? But also, I was wondering, do you think it's maybe also in addition, you know, that they're all like technologically, like, you know, pharmacologically, or how you'd call this, that they all come, you know, that are all elements of the same goal to kind of get you sick, you know? Because, like, I mean, there's stuff in the tests, you know, the swabs that we know that is not good, and the mask is kind of making you more, you know, that you maybe get infected more easily with a virus or like a flu or whatever, and then we have this. So could it also be that it's like a really elegantly orchestrated, like, you know, on a medical basis, you know, that this also...
I think what you're saying is correct. It's difficult for people, if we say that we are reasonable people, we're going to say that we, the assembled company here today, We're not perfect, but we're reasonable people, and we're concerned about our fellow man and woman. That's what's in our heads. When you have that in your head, it's very difficult for you then to look at somebody who is unleashing an utterly brutal plan on people. If even tens of thousands of elderly people were deliberately killed in UK, and I believe the evidence for that is overwhelming, then the people who took the decision to kill the elderly people are also capable of taking the decision to kill off other members of society that they don't believe are worth anything. I have, just to come back on psychology and documents, I have a National Health Service document which is talking about patient safety. And it says, if we did this or that, we could perhaps save the lives of 160 people per year. That would be worth 23 million. Every time the NHS document is talking about protecting human beings, it puts a financial value to that. And when I see those sentences, I know that the person who's written that document does not think in the way that I suspect we all think. So what they're doing to the children with the masks and the social distancing and giving them lessons in how dangerous the virus is, that is frightening the children. This is all a psychological attack on their minds, and the people doing it know full well this is going to result in all sorts of mental health problems in the children. And if you look at, there's a very important paper which is called the Biderman Chart of Coercion. This is a World Health Organized recognized paper about non-physical techniques of torture. Virtually every COVID pandemic measure can be listed, ticked off against one of the Biderman charts. And as I was waiting to come live with you, a lady, very well-informed lady, has sent me a document where in UK they're now saying that if a baby is born and there is any suspicion that that child may test positive for COVID, there should be no skin contact.
It's really getting out of hand. Do you think that the spin for this whole thing is written in England? Do you think it's the spider in the web, what you discovered together with the French people? Or is this like an American script? It must be like centrally organized somehow.
Well, this of course is a very, very interesting question, because when I talked about the destabilization chart, that allegedly was part of a communist plan to destabilize the West. But I think that if we take a more mature view of it at the moment, of course, if we look at the power base, and at the moment we're focused on the power base of the pharmaceutical companies, the power base is within the networks of those companies. And of course, those companies can only function without the people who control their billions of dollars of working capital and profits. So for me, it's very easy to say that if you want to start working out who is doing this, then you have to look at who is actually controlling the sums of money. And of course, this can be quite emotive, depending on how you put this argument across. But in UK, the government, which has not been able to build hospitals, which can't fill in holes in the road, which can't run the schools, suddenly announces that we've got £800 billion, which has appeared out of thin air, yes, in order to fight the COVID. Mm-hmm. Well, this tells us something very important. And the other thing, which I think is significant at the moment, is you might have thought a few years ago that if such a pandemic happened, at this stage, when the economy is so badly hit, we would be hearing the banks complain. we would be hearing the banks saying that this is disastrous because the UK economy shrunk by 30 to 40%. The banks can't function, but actually the banks are silent.
Yes.
And that says to me that the banks are happy. They must be happy because they're silent.
It is according to what we have learned in the meantime, it's the bank, it's high finance, which is profiting from all this through their investments in the pharmaceutical and the tech industry. But the bottom line of all this, if this is an agenda, and I have no doubt that it is an agenda, it's a calculated effort. The bottom line of all this is that the killing of the middle class, of the small and medium-sized businesses, of driving them into bankruptcy, and the actual deaths, killing of people, is not a collateral damage. It's the intended damage, right?
It's intended, probably 9 months ago. I can't substantiate it further because it was a whistleblower, but a whistleblower who had clearly been within some reasonably high level meetings within the British government told us he was shocked that at one stage they discussed the need to destroy small to medium sized businesses. He said it was discussed in a way that was so cold. He said it really disturbed him. When he came out of the meeting, he could not believe what he had just heard. And of course, the Bank of England, I can't remember the new governor's name, unfortunately, but Mark Carney, even when he was governor of the Bank of England, announced publicly several times that companies that did not adhere to the new climate change greening agenda would be punished. They would be put out of business. He said that publicly. And anybody operating a small business should have really paid attention to what that man was talking about. And of course, if you stop small businesses from working, you are stopping people from earning a living. And when they can't pay to live, when they can't pay to eat, that also increases mental health problems. So this is, the word in English is malevolent. It's a poisonous agenda, but it's deliberate because it's being spoken in Parliament and it's appearing in the documents that are being put out.
And so, what was the pseudo argument that the government or people from the government used when they talked about that the small and medium-sized businesses would need to be taken out?
Well, of course, they're selling
climate change,
they're selling to the wider population that there is a climate change problem, and it's desperate that we take every and any measure, any and every measure, to deal with the climate issue. And if that means that a few hundred thousand small businesses are going to be destroyed, well, that's what's got to happen. So the fear factor, which is the constant thing, the psychology is based on fear and control. We should be fearful it's going to end because of climate change. We've got to be fearful of a pandemic. We've got to be fearful of a war with China and Russia. This is deliberate, calculated psychology. And to my mind, this is why, if we want to fight what's happening with COVID and vaccination, then we have to address this issue as well. Absolutely. When we can prove that our governments are lying and using propaganda, that has to be hit as hard as saying to the public, we can show you that the vaccines are dangerous because of the statistics around adverse reactions. We have to do the two things simultaneously. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, it's an irony, but lockdown has been very good for the UK column because many, many more people are coming to us. And every week, we will probably get 6, 7, 8 emails where people say, we would like to thank you for keeping us sane.
Yeah.
your news, your information, your facts, your analysis has helped keep us sane.
Yeah.
Because we were getting distressed, we were getting anxious. And that is a huge compliment to us. That is something very special those people are telling us. But of course, what it also told us was how powerful this effect was on the minds of the public.
And I have one last question, basically. So we have the feeling, and it's maybe connected to what you said about this neuro-linguistic programming, as that's what NLP is, because no one, maybe people don't know what that is.
NLP, you know, I think people know it.
People know it, yeah.
Germany,
so, but
under the same name.
Yeah, so because we think, we have the feeling that people are under some sort of spell. We've discussed this with, you know, a lot of psychologists. Yeah, is this a spell? Was heißt Wahn?
The spell, we also believe this. This is where we've come to. We can say that people are under a spell. And the best description we believe is that they've been mesmerized.
Yeah, mesmerized. But do you think how can we break through this spell? Like, is there a way?
Because
it's information.
We have to get the information out, because knowledge is what kills the illusion. Real knowledge kills the illusion that they've created.
This is true, but we also have to be realistic, and that is that if you look at what happens if you attempt to hypnotize a group of people, then you get a bell distribution curve. Some people are very susceptible to it and will be extremely hypnotized. Some people might be slightly affected, and some people it's very difficult to hypnotize. So across the population, I believe you need to think about it in a little bit more of a measured way. You're going to have some people that probably we're not going to get to. They're gone. They can't think for themselves. Mm. And you will have other people, you are clearly some, I hope I'm one, where we see through what's happening. It doesn't matter what they say or show us, we can see what the truth is. So by exposing it and putting out the correct information ourselves, we are getting through that hypnosis. And to be positive, I think that is accelerating.
Yes.
The British government has just announced that it's spending £1.6 billion to interface with media companies. £1.6 billion. The BBC's budget is £5 billion on its own. So £5 billion BBC, which is the biggest propaganda machine the world has ever seen. It is the most dangerous organization. You should not believe anything the BBC says without checking it via another source.
Yes.
I could talk to you for an hour about what the BBC really is.
Yeah, well, we have the very same problem with our national public radio and television stations, I believe. It may be worse in Great Britain, however, with the BBC, because I think your history is a lot longer with that kind of propaganda.
I'm sorry, I didn't answer the lady's question fully on whether I thought the seat for this was in the UK. I am very embarrassed to say that I do believe it is in UK. We are looking at the power base, which is a mixture of the monetary power in the City of London. And what is very clear from the documentation is that monetary power base is now fully working with the wider security services. So this is part of what in UK they are calling the fusion doctrine. That's another discussion. But essentially, we can see that the monetary power base is now controlling both the intelligence networks like GCHQ, but also the secret services, and they are acting together. And when it is fact, because it is fact, I assure you, but it was announced publicly, very quietly, that we now have both Google and GCHQ, the British Signals Intelligence Organization, working inside the NHS. This is outrageous.
Yes, it is.
Right?
Yeah. But it's the picture is coming out. It's becoming ever clearer for more and more people to understand, to first see and then ask questions and understand. Yes. That's why they're pushing so hard, because they understand that something is going off the rails right now.
Yes, they're understanding that people are waking up, and we are seeing this. There is a huge, I think that there's been a great, what's the description? Social media has stabilized, I think. I think in many places on social media, you're seeing a huge improvement in the quality and the accuracy of information coming out. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they ever realized that people would use social media for professional analysis and reporting, as you're doing today. And this frightens them a lot.
Good.
So I think we've got to expose what's going on. And the other thing that we have learnt over, I'll say, 10 years, is that it's always better to slightly understate what you're talking about. If you tell it reasonably gently, you can always come back and have another go.
Yeah.
But if you're too aggressive, if you're too forceful, if you scare people, then you lose them.
Yeah.
So we've tried to always be talking about what's happening very quietly in a measured way. And also we don't cover all of the things that we're watching. So take an example of people are talking about magnets sticking to you after an injection. Now, I don't know whether that's true or not. I'm interested to follow it to see. But I'm not going to report on it, because until I can prove it, mm-hmm. I don't want to say anything that could undermine what else we've talked about. So I think the business of not being caught up in being too outspoken and aggressive helps the people to come to us to absorb the information.
Mm-hmm. Well,
if you want to be... If you want to end on a really positive note, I decided I would put some greenery behind me today, because I wondered whether a little bit of sunshine and some greenness might lift our spirits a bit. I believe that something very interesting has happened in the last few months, well, I'll say 4 or 5 months. Professional people are beginning to ask the right questions. And I think the speed that this is happening is now causing all of these strange decisions you're seeing by the establishment. Fauci, the rush to get the children vaccinated, even when they haven't got the rest of the policy through. This, to me, is a sign that they are very frightened people. And the last thing I'd like to say, and I have to smile when I say it, is that... There was an activist in America, in Chicago, called Saul Alinsky, and he wrote an extremely good book, which is called Rules for Radicals. And in the book, he's talking essentially about techniques to overthrow government. But one of the things he says is always make the argument personal.
That's what we're doing.
Right.
Yes.
So it's not enough to talk about the BBC. You've got to talk about Tim Davie, who is the Director General of the BBC. It's not enough for me to talk about the MHRA. I've got to talk about Dr. June Rain, who is the Chief Executive. And the other little thing which you can accept or laugh at, I'm very happy either way, is that even in writing to some of these officials, it's very powerful if you put their picture on the letter or the email that you send to them. Because what it does is it takes it from a dry communication to actually putting straight into their minds that you are looking at them as an individual. And of course, what am I doing here? I'm using applied psychology, but if the bad people use it on us, I think we can use a little bit of it back on them.
Well, that's what we're doing, actually. We're making this personal. We're going after the people personally, not after the institutions.
Yes.
But, well, Brian, I thank you very, very much. This was extremely interesting and very important. And I think we're going to be able to hear more of each other because we have to stay in touch now that we realize, I mean, we've had this suspicion all along, but now that we realize that this is an internationally concerted effort by some very, yes. very evil people.
And what a wonderful opportunity that is, because whatever else these people do, they're constantly pitting nations against nations. If we get a little bit broader and we look back at the wars and the trouble, it was this type of people that have caused it. And I think we've got a wonderful opportunity now to the pandemic that's been thrown at us to make us fearful could actually be the very thing to get people coming back as human beings, no matter, you know, what their nationality or religion or color is. I think we've got a very exciting opportunity here.
Yeah, definitely.
We agree. It's a real pleasure, Brian.
Thanks so much.
We'll be in touch. I think we'll talk more.
Okay, that would be nice. Can I just say to you, unfortunately, you're just off my screen, so I only see... Ah, that's better.
Sorry,
I only see an eye, and this could worry a lot of people.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Brian. It's a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. Very important.
Okay.
Have a great weekend.
You too.